This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events.
Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for joining the forum today called African Politics Today, What Progressives Need to Know. My name's Lee Wengraff, and I'm with the International Committee of the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. I'm based in New York City. In the International Committee, we have a number of regional subcommittees, as well as work on eco-socialism, labor, and many more, all in the efforts to build global solidarity. And we put this event together today as a first of a series of educational events on politics and activism on the African continent. And we wanted to launch this series because for a lot of people on the left, on the U.S. left, there's an interest, but also some gaps in terms of understanding African politics, history, and struggles, as well as U.S. foreign policy there, and also in the interest of reframing some common thinking about African politics. So, I mean, specifically for many in the U.S., I think Africa is viewed really as a continent, only as a continent steeped in crisis, and it's understood simply in terms of famine, poverty, civil wars, and corruption, and that the roots of these conditions are somehow kind of naturally occurring features of African nations themselves. They're somehow intrinsic to the way that African societies are set up. And for activists, that doesn't actually leave much room for seeing those on the continent with agency and with history. So this event today and future ones is really part of a contribution to a more nuanced understanding of current events, of African nations and societies, really as those enmeshed historically and today within a global system and with rich traditions of resistance, from anti-colonial revolutions to pro-democracy movements and struggles against neoliberal austerity and much more. So we're really glad to have such a great panel of speakers here today to flesh out this framework and for us and to support our project in the International Committee of Building Internationalism and Solidarity. So thank you so much for joining. And also a thanks as well to Haymarket Books for co-hosting this event with us. So now I'm going to turn to introducing our panelists, and I'm going to go in alphabetical order. First of all, to start, Nisreen El Amin, who is an assistant professor of international studies at Bryn Mawr College, and she's an anthropologist who researches land rights, extractive industries, foreign land grabs, and the militarization of borders in East Africa and the Sahel. Then we have Zachariah Mempilly, who's the Marx Chair of International Affairs at the City University of New York, and he is the author of Rebel Rulers, Insurgent Governance, and Civilian Life During War, and the co-author of Africa Uprising, Popular Protest, and Political Change. We also have Jason Stearns, who's the director of the Congo Research Group at NYU, assistant professor of international studies at Simon Fraser University, and the author of Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa, and The War Doesn't Say Its Name, Why Conflict Endures in the Congo. And last but not least, Joseph Waldens, who is assistant professor in the Department of African American and African Studies and affiliated faculty in political science at the University of Minnesota. He received his PhD from Indiana University in political science, and his research interests are in the areas of elite politics, authoritarian regimes, political institutions, and social network analysis with a geographical focus on Africa. So the way this forum is going to run, we're going to have about 45 minutes of a roundtable discussion with the four panelists. And then what we'll do is we'll open it up for questions for you all in the audience. And we'll go from there. So without further ado, I'm going to kick it off with a question, the first question for the panelists, which is I'd love to hear from all of you, what are some of the protest traditions and social movements in your countries of expertise, both historically and some of the current dynamics, as well as additional context that would help those of us on the left in the U.S. Who might be less familiar with this background. And what I'll do is I'll kick it off first to Zachariah, who will fill in some of this and give us a little bit of a continent-wide picture as well. So, Zachariah, please take it away.
Thank you, Lee, and thank you all for joining us today. It's really wonderful to be here with such an esteemed group of panelists. I'm really excited for this conversation. I'm really excited that it's the first of what I hope are many such panels that bring to U.S. left a more internationalist perspective, especially one that centers some of the events and movements that are ongoing on the continent. Let me just start by saying, we are very aware that Africa is a vast place, 55 countries, very different politics and economies, many. But we wanted to explicitly do something that talked about Africa as a whole. I think there's a number of reasons for this, and I wanted to try to explore these in more detail. And we also want to be able to talk more specifically about individual cases in the African context, knowing full well that they don't necessarily represent what's happening across the continent itself. That being said, one of the things that comes to mind when we talk about African resistance movements in particular is that there is the continuity that has defined African social movements over time. When I was working on the book with Adam Branch, Africa Uprising, one of the things that we wanted to do as outsiders was really try to situate the contemporary wave of African protest within this longer history of African struggles. And in order to do that, we really began in the beginning, which was movements that emerged to resist European colonialism as early as the 1920s, but really picking up speed in the 1940s and 1950s. And one of the things that was really striking for us, reading many of the figures who were involved in these movements at the time, was how much they were in conversation with each other, with other scholars and activists on the continent, but also how internationalist they were in terms of constructing an African resistance. And there were many sites in which this occurred. There were obviously conferences that occurred in places like Europe and the United States, but also many that were held on the African continent itself. And in these spaces, you had really seminal debates between key figures, people like Frantz Fanon, Kwame Nkrumah, and others, around what is the appropriate form of resistance for Africa in that given moment. And what we saw in the 1940s and 50s is that these debates shaped the nature of many different nationalist struggles that were unfolding across the continent at the time. And so that by the 1950s, it became increasingly clear that many of these movements were starting to have an impact on dismantling European colonial institutions. So I think it's useful to take this continental perspective, because what we see is that there is, in fact, a lot of dialogue and discourse, not only between African activists, but also between African activists and internationalist actors globally. If we look back at this first wave of African protests in the 1940s and 1950s, we can see that it was actually quite successful. By the early 1960s, the vast majority of African countries had become independent. Most of them emerged as newly independent states, many adopting somewhat leftist politics and in some cases actually overt forms of socialist rule on the African continent. But they also were limited in many ways. And one of the things that I think is very interesting, if you take the chronological perspective on what's been happening in Africa across, say, the past 70, 80 years, is the ways in which protest itself has evolved over time. So if we look back at the 1940s and 50s, many of these were personality-centric movements that really centered the role of the political party. And so what you see across Africa in the 1960s and 1970s are a variety of one-party states, often led by very dynamic, but also fairly autocratic individual political leaders. If we look at the sort of second major wave of African protests that follows in the 1980s and 1990s, we see how they are responding to this earlier wave. So the earlier wave can really be understood as successful in the sense that it did dismantle European rule, but it did not lead to the type of economic and political liberation that many of the activists who were participating in these struggles were actually advocating for. Instead, it was that period in African history was characterized by one-party states, many of whom were fairly autocratic in terms of how they dealt with the civilian population, and largely worked to suppress opposition movements across the continent. In the 80s and 90s, you see a new wave of African protests. Many of these protests are emerging in response to very brutal structural adjustment programs. The 80s and 90s in Africa were a period of austerity, largely pushed by the international financial institutions. But what's really interesting about these protests that really start to kick off in the 1980s in Sudan, which we'll hear more about today, is that they also started to argue against and to resist very openly the one-party state in Africa. And so you see the emergence of a democratization discourse. You see that even as these movements are able to overthrow long-standing leaders in many parts of the continent, they are also able to sort of call for new forms of political rule across their countries. And we start to see the emergence of a form of democratization taking place in Africa by the 1990s. So prior to the 1990s, only about three African countries were even remotely democratic in any sense. And then you see this rapid period of democratization in the 1990s really continuing into the 2000s. This was largely a success story, but once again, the ordinary people who constituted the bulk of the protesters who were most directly involved in these social movements that led to this period of democratization were again pushed aside by political elites and political parties. So rather than a genuine economic and political transformation of the sort that was being called for by the protesters, what you see in the 1990s is really a narrow form of electoral party competition becoming the de facto form of government across the African continent. While this is certainly progress from the one-party states that predated this period, what we find very quickly is that, you know, some of the same political elites who had participated in these one-party states simply switched sides to form new political parties and were able to capture power as a result of these newly held elections. Or incumbent regimes that had been in power really through the independence, really from the beginning of the independence period, simply started to hold elections because that seemed to satisfy the international demand for democratization, even as they failed to make any sort of substantive political and economic changes in the African context. And so you see very quickly, even somewhat left-wing parties like the African National Congress in South Africa, rather than bringing about the sort of massive economic transformation that many South Africans were calling for in the 1990s, largely adopts a neoliberal frame throughout the 1990s and 2000 period explicitly. That brings us to today. So what is it? The last thing I want to say before I pass it on to the panelists, you know, again, this question of is this specific to particular countries or is this a continental wide trend? You know, what we have been researching really for the past 5-6 years now is how broad the current wave of African protest has been. Again, we can trace it back to somewhere maybe around the mid-2000s when there were massive protests in places like Ethiopia, another country I hope we can talk more about today, but really picking up steam in the early 2010s, where you see the frequency of these sort of mass popular movements emerging all over the continent. Of course, 2011 represents a high point where you have the so-called Arab Spring. One thing that is often forgotten is that the Arab Spring is primarily taking place in the African context, and that the North African countries that were at the center of the Arab Spring were just a small sliver of the number of countries that had mass popular movements during this period. And if we follow the next 10 years until today, what we have seen is that this protest wave has not really diminished. Rather, we have seen large popular movements in over 40 African countries out of 55 since 2010, that these protests continue into the present day. And that unlike earlier, the earlier two waves that I've just described, that these movements seem to be much more cynical about the role of political parties. And so I think one of the key debates that we want to discuss today is, you know, again, what is the relationship between social movements and electoral politics? And the second point, this is my last one, who actually constitutes these popular movements? Are they led, as earlier movements were, by political elites working closely with political parties? Or are they bringing in more and more ordinary people, people from the peripheral areas of urban spaces, people from the rural areas who have historically been left out of African social movements? These are the kinds of things that I think we really need to look more closely at individual cases to discern the similarities, but also the many differences that exist at the national level. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Zachariah. And so on that note, just to open it up to the other panels, who would like to kind of jump in and make some comments?
Maybe I'll start by talking briefly about the revolution that continues in Sudan. It's entered a new phase, but I think it's still ongoing. And so I want to actually make a larger point about international solidarity in talking about the Sudanese revolution. It's where I'm originally from. And I guess I'll start by saying that I, before becoming an academic, I worked in international development, community organizing, and I worked for an organization called Grassroots International that partners with social movements in countries where the U.S. has had a particularly negative policy impact, like Mexico, Haiti, Palestine, South Africa. And we would basically fund groups like the Treatment Action Center in South Africa that were fighting for access to antiretroviral medications that were generic. And to me at the time, this was like international solidarity work at its best. But the Sudanese revolution really changed that for me. So just to kind of give you a little bit of context, in December of 2018, the revolution gained momentum in Sudan and mass support because of a convergence of kind of decade-old grievances against state violence and marginalization in peripheral areas, with rural demands for land reform and urban calls for justice and economic security. And people were basically united in this desire to not only overthrow a 30-year brutal military dictatorship under al-Bashir, but to really completely reimagine the economic, political, and social future of the country. This is not our first revolution. We had one in 64, one in 85, and so we kind of followed that tradition. But it was really a kind of opening moment in many ways. And as the revolution spread to 23 towns and cities across Sudan, it became clear that it was led by very grassroots formations, working class unions, feminist and youth groups, neighborhood resistance community committees, and generally disgruntled folks who were struggling to survive. What was clear was that the traditional opposition parties, and even one of the white collar unions that emerged as a quasi leader and representative of the revolution in the current transitional government, were neither leading or really prepared for what was unfolding as they kind of scrambled to co-opt the very radical political organizing that continues to drive the revolution. And so I want to speak briefly about one of these formations. There are these neighborhood committees that formed in towns across Sudan. They're kind of these informal neighborhood-wide networks of people. They emerged in the 2010s to coordinate civil disobedience actions against cuts in fuel and food subsidies that were recommended by the IMF, land seizures and raids carried out by the secret police of the former regime. My 83-year-old father, who built barricades against police invasions during the revolution alongside youth from these committees, considers them the kind of backbone of the revolution in the urban areas. In places like Ar-Rahad, which is in the western part of Sudan, neighborhood committees broke down government zakat stores where wheat and other basic food items were stored and redistributed them in their communities. So as a member of the diaspora, I wanted to figure out how we could support these committees financially through advocacy, et cetera. And I was struggling to figure out how do you do international solidarity work within this context. And I was constantly met with this very gentle and kind reminder that groups carrying the revolution did not want money, much less money originating from the US. And that people reminded me that intervention and engagement, particularly from the US, whether through grants, from U.S. foundations or NGOs or government agencies, or even through the diaspora, often have a kind of de-radicalizing effect and sort of hinder the work of these radical grassroots groups. And it took me really a while to internalize this point, that international solidarity actually means not overstating our role as diaspora in the events that are unfolding back home. I think it means holding back from speaking on behalf of, resisting the urge to throw money on something, right? That people's desire for less rather than more U.S. intervention or engagement, even if it's a positive kind of engagement, needs to be respected. And I think this can apply to anywhere really on the continent. So for example, and I just want to give this as a final point here. I remember a couple of years ago, a group called Girifna, which is a youth activist group from Sudan. Girifna means we are fed up, and they've been very involved in the revolution. We had a meeting with members of the diaspora in Boston. I'm affiliated with the group. And there was someone from a foundation affiliated with the CEO of eBay present, who was insisting on funding Girifna. And I'll never forget how skillfully and politely one of the Girifna activists told the person that they were and would never be interested in their support because they're anti-capitalist and because they stand in solidarity with workers in the US who are fighting corporate exploitation and monopolies. And so to be clear, it doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities for some engagement guided by people on the ground. The Movement for Black Lives, after reaching out to youth groups and activists in Sudan, issued an important solidarity statement in the wake of a brutal massacre that occurred in July of 2019, carried out by security forces that broke up the sit-in that had gathered hundreds and thousands of people in front of the military headquarters in Sudan for several months, demanding a full transition to civilian rule. And this was part of a larger effort by groups on the ground to strategically draw international attention to the massacre and to what was happening. Similarly, a group of people of color anarchists in Chicago sent encrypted phones and laptops to youth activists during an internet blackout after we ask them what would be most useful. But the basic point I want to leave you with is that the role we play in solidarity with folks around the world, and in particular in relation to popular movements and uprisings on the continent, is perhaps more restrained and limited than we sometimes imagine or desire it to be. Thank you.
Yeah, I can jump in here. You guys can hear me okay? I think there's been some feedback. Cool. It's great to participate in this. Thanks a lot for the invite. This is a great forum, hopefully the first of many. I'm going to talk a little bit about the area that I'm focused on, which is Central Africa and mostly the Democratic Republic of the Congo, to understand a little bit how social movements there have participated and to draw a lot on what both Zachariah and Nisreen have been talking about. I think there's a nice convergence of a lot of dynamics. And so the DRC, much like Sudan, much like many other places in Africa, has seen waves of social movements since independence in 1960, and a real uptick in mobilization in 2015 by social movements that, as Zachariah pointed out, were largely independent of political parties at the time, largely youth movements based in urban areas, and mostly focused on political change at the top of the country. This was a time when the then president, Joseph Kabila, was trying to hang on to power. He was trying to, as many African presidents have done, change their constitution so they remain in power, in his case, for a third term. And these youth movements, I guess the most important ones were Lucha and Filimbi, but especially Lucha, then embarked in a series of very courageous demonstrations and started a broad coalition with political parties, civil society organizations, and the Catholic Church that did receive backing from foreign donors, including the United States. This mobilized enormous numbers of people between 2015 and 2018. It blocked the change of constitution. And then it made it impossible for Joseph Kabila then to impose his own handpicked successor. And so at elections in 2018, his party and coalition was forced to at least partially step down from power, although the elections were deeply flawed. So there was an enormous number of successes, but I think it also points at a bunch of sort of cross-cutting dynamics that are important to highlight that also hold for other countries in Africa. So social movements in the Congo have been successful where they've been coupled with political parties and civil society. You can see this in Burkina Faso, for example, where they threw out the government of Blaise Compaoré. You can see this in Senegal, where, again, a broad-based coalition of political opposition, youth movements led by Yon Ammar, blocked Abdoulaye Wade from remaining in power there. You can even see it in historic elections in Kenya that ended Moi's dictatorship in 2002. And you can see it in the fall of apartheid in South Africa in 1991. In each of these cases, you have a coming together of both social movements as well as political parties, opposition movements, and civil society. The focus of many of these mobilizations in the case of the Congo, Senegal, Burkina Faso has been, and I guess Sudan, I would say it would be interesting to talk, Ms. Rina, but I see it as an exception to this a little bit. But the focus of many of these movements have been on elections and on overthrowing the people in power. Now, the problem with this is that once the government is removed, as happened in many of these cases, so there's been enormous successes. Once the government is then removed, that coalition almost always falls apart. Some of those in that coalition join the government. In the case of the Congo, you could see, for example, many of the leading civil society figures either join or express or be co-opted in some shape or form by the government. And also, I think what this tends to do is something that we're seeing in the United States a little bit. It tends to conflate the broader problems, structural problems of society with the individual in power. And so there's this notion that the problem in the Congo is Joseph Kabila. Once he is removed from power, then that's enough. The problem in Burkina Faso is Blaise Compaoré, and the problem in Senegal was Abdoulaye Wade. The problem in the United States is Donald Trump, right? And the problem with this is that this hasn't, even though they've been successful and very courageous, often at the cost of enormous bloodshed, in kicking out many of these abusive governments, this has not yet led to the broad-based structural change that many African countries require. So Africa is still, broadly speaking, a place of extraction. You know, in a couple of years, Africa will host a third of humanity, and yet by 2050, and yet Africa constitutes around 3% of world GDP. Half of Africa's exports are raw materials. And these movements that Zachariah was pointing out, so the democracy movement that really succeeded in ushering in, you know, democratic elections, which is sort of the name of the game in most of Africa now, did not succeed, also liberalized the economy. And so you had a rush of both democratization as well as neoliberalism in Africa. So the economies have been privatized. You've had a ghettoization of urban areas, erosion of public goods go hand in hand. I think one of the epitomes of this is something that's happening as we speak right now. Elections were held yesterday in Uganda, where the president in power, Yoweri Museveni, is trying to stay in power after 34 years in power. And he's being faced by a political opposition member who I think has a lot in common with these youth movements, these social movements across the continent. He's a former musician. He's extremely popular. He himself comes from the urban poor, Bobby Wine, Robert Kyagulanyi. And he has been extremely courageous, you know, facing death threats, facing enormous brutality, being beaten down. And yet he says he has no problem with the policies of the current president. His problem is that the president himself has wanted to stay in power. And so I think this is one of the struggles we see with this current generation of social movements across Africa. They're enormously courageous. And yet when they try, such as in the case of Yon Ammar and Lucha in Senegal and the Congo, when they try to articulate a critique of the economy, of the political economy, they're much less successful at doing that than criticizing the people in power and bringing about political change at the top. And so I'll stop there.
I guess I'll chime in for a little bit here as well, focusing more so on Ethiopia and Eritrea here in this case, in terms of the role of social movements in essentially laying the groundwork for what we're seeing today happening in Eritrea and Ethiopia. In fact, social movements folks were at that time sort of the radical Marxist students attending universities where the to the forefront of critiquing what was then Haile Selassie's government, the sort of imperial government that functioned in a particular kind of way. And these younger folks really leveraging Marxist theory as a way of critiquing and sort of framing the status quo as essentially feudalism. But that social movement from protests quickly transform into actual armed rebellions. And you had rebel groups popping up all across what was then Eritrea and Ethiopia, sort of one empire, sort of Ethiopia. And what's interesting about protest movements, from my perspective, is essentially it's this transformation or this translation from grievances to then articulate some sort of some understanding as to who's culpable, what's the problem, and what's the solution, so to speak. And there's this sort of there's this act of imagination that's happening here. And in the case of Eritrea and Ethiopia, this is happening with actual guns. People are literally going to war, essentially proposing different kinds of ideas. And at the end, the ones that won out was in Eritrea, the EPLF, the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, and in Ethiopia, it was the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Now, this is just two among many organizations at the time were all across the country. And it's current, the ethnic federalism that you're seeing in Ethiopia was instituted by the Tigray People's Liberation Front. They had that ideology to start out with, seeing their grievances early on during Haile Selassie's regime as essentially the problem here is that one ethnicity is dominating another ethnicity. Interestingly, it's at times foe and at times allies, the Eritrean People's Liberation Front to the north, saw the issue more in terms of Eritrea having been a former colony, and just like all the other colonies across Africa, should have had been granted its independence instead of being merged with Ethiopia. Right? And so articulated a different kind of vision forward. And in fact, the very people that we see actually in conflict today, I mean, the TPLF, for those who don't know, it's the Tigray region, the northern parts of Ethiopia, where currently we're seeing, essentially it's a war that has been unfolding there, a humanitarian tragedy, and it's risking even to engulf now. Sudan is at the border, now also getting involved, and the issues quickly get more complex. I know we're going to deal with this more in the second question. But the point being is that the imagination that under which or that the TPLF worked with or created became the framework in the 90s when they took over that then defined the political landscape as ethnic federalism. Now, there's some proponents and there's some critics of this, but it does raise the question of how social movements speak back to this. And in some ways, I think, Jason, what you just, well, I think all the panelists have mentioned here, maybe regime change isn't so much the end goal, but more so that when you have sustained protest, really drawing attention and sort of in a sustained way, pointing out deeper problems. So for instance, in Ethiopia was the Oromo protest that was really pointing out the kinds of oppression that the government was perpetrating. But it was even deeper than that, that the imagination of what is Ethiopia needed to be, essentially reimagined. Right? And so perhaps in that sense, social movements may be at its best, not necessarily when overturning a government or overthrowing a government, but more so by bringing to the mainstream a certain kind of discourse that eventually elites can no longer hide from it. Right? So I'll just leave it at that.
Thanks so much, Joseph, and everybody. Those were really great contributions. And just to move it along, I'm going to just pivot to the next question really quick, and then we'll open it up for discussion, which is that I was wondering if all of you could speak a bit to more of the kind of geopolitics and foreign policy and the role of so-called external actors in Africa, both sort of more of the established powers like the U.S. and China, as well as some of the, you know, kind of newer players, so to speak, on the continent, and just, you know, overall, what is Africa's place in the world right now? So perhaps we could start with Nisreen and kind of go around the table again.
Okay, sure. I guess I can start a little bit by talking about investment, because that's kind of my area of expertise, and then kind of pivot. I think actually Sudan is a good example of the way that the U.S. Engages with African countries. If we look at sort of U.S. policy over the last few years, so actually, yeah, maybe I'll just start with that, and people can sort of interject as you will if there are connections. But I want to kind of start off with the Muslim ban and the way that the Trump administration, at the time included, it should really be called the African ban, because with its various iterations is always, new African countries get added. But Sudan was added to this travel ban list, and it was a bit of an odd kind of addition. And I was detained under the ban, and I remember the people who interrogated me couldn't actually explain to me why Sudan had been put on the list, which goes to show in some ways how uninformed a lot of our policies are towards the continent. But in any case, Sudan was later dropped from the travel ban list in return for sending more troops to fight the war in Yemen on Saudi Arabia and the Emirates' behalf. And so basically the travel ban was used to kind of extort political favors. The UAE and Saudi Arabia lobbied on Sudan's behalf in Washington. In addition to that, Chad was then added. And that was also a curious addition, and it had apparently to do with the fact that they hadn't digitized their passports. But really what was happening in my mind, and this is sort of more speculation, is that the Secretary of State under Trump at the time, Rex Tillerson, was a former CEO of ExxonMobil, and was embroiled in a 3-year dispute with the Chadian government over several billion dollar tax fine that they had not paid. And so Chad was briefly added. Then ExxonMobil, because Rex Tillerson was the former CEO, settled that disagreement, and then it was removed from the ban list. So I bring these up as examples of the way that policies are being used to kind of extort these political favors, et cetera. I think another example that I want to bring is during the revolution, the U.S. Embassy put a Facebook post up. This was in February at the height of the revolution, but also at the height of the counter-revolution. And this kind of speaks to Jason's point earlier. I think what really is happening in Sudan is that people do have a very strong critique, a political economy critique, but that often what happens when transitional governments are formed is that the more radical elements of the revolution that are pushing beyond regime change get kind of marginalized and sometimes institutionalized, if you will, right? So for example, you have these neighborhood resistance committees, the NED, which is a National Endowment for Democracy, right? A congressionally funded group, has been funding groups to then channel funding into these neighborhood resistance committees. And I think to me, this is an indication of the way that they're trying to kind of rein in the radical elements of the revolution as the U.S. is preparing to kind of ramp up its investments in Sudan. So during the revolution, there was a Facebook post of a senior official under Obama who had continued to serve under Trump, meeting with Bashir officials to discuss investment opportunities in energy, mining, and infrastructure. A few months later, al-Bashir is ousted and jailed, and U.S. officials are kind of hailing the democracy, congratulating Sudanese people for letting democracy prevail. And so, again, I want to just kind of point out this hypocrisy here, but also to give you another example. The Millennium Challenge Corporation is a U.S. foreign aid agency established by Congress under Bush. Mike Pompeo and Steve Mnuchin sit on its board. And Niger is among its largest recipients of funds, mostly for agriculture and women's empowerment projects. And you might ask, why Niger? Well, during the Obama administration, Niger was chosen as the site of a massive new U.S. drone facility to act as a kind of strategic foothold in West Africa and its anti-terrorism work in partnership with France. Niger also provides France with most of its kind of nuclear energy through uranium. So it's a kind of key place. And again, you see kind of granting agency, right, that's supposed to be doing development, using its funds to essentially open up countries to serve their political, in this case, military interests, right? And then finally, as a last example, I want to talk about recently in October of 2020, Sudan had plunged deeper into economic crisis, and the transitional government under Hamdok is now trying to gain access to emergency funds for COVID, to fight COVID, the COVID pandemic. And so basically, they're trying to get funds from the IMF and to seek forgiveness for its $64 billion national debt. And so the Trump administration essentially bullies Sudan into normalizing relations with Israel and into paying a $335 million fine to compensate families of U.S. citizens killed in an al-Qaeda bombing of U.S. American embassies in East Africa. And so, again, I use this as an example to show the way that I think for the last couple of decades, our policy towards African countries has been shaped by hypocrisy and arrogance, and that hasn't really changed from one sort of democratic or, you know, Republican administrations. And I think we'll have much more competent and knowledgeable people in the Biden administration, but I don't think that this will change a lot. And I don't think that, I think the tone will change, but I don't think that the dynamics that I've been describing will change. I think there'll be a continued effort to open up African markets. There'll be, I think, an effort to exploit African labor resources and to kind of position U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, India, and the Emirates in an effort to kind of weaken China's influence on the continent. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Nisreen. I'm going to throw it open to the other three panelists. And just to say that we're running a little bit short on time, and we're getting a bunch of really awesome questions in. So maybe I'll ask the remaining three if you want to keep comments a tiny bit shorter, and then we can dig into the questions from the audience. So go ahead, anyone who might want to jump in here.
I guess I'll say a quick word. I guess, I mean, I don't know how well-versed our audience is, but when it does come to external actors, I think in many respects, think of it in the same way that we speak about sort of Russian influence on the elections in 2016, but amplified and manifold over than that, where other than manipulating, that you have, for instance, money flowing directly to actors whose sole purpose is to undermine whatever, you know, the external actor deems to be problematic or don't like it. And I guess if you want to get, rather than sort of getting mired down on like the intricacies of the different actors right now, I would actually recommend that you watch, it's a documentary called Cuba, an African Odyssey. It's a two-part documentary. And I'm not sure if I've ever seen another documentary that captures the dynamic once you have external actors coming in and how that can actually fuel conflict that is already happening. So if you want to get a better grasp of that, I would highly recommend that you watch that documentary.
Yeah, I'll just jump in real quick to sort of reinforce some of the points I think that Nisreen was making. I think that I don't think the U.S. has a coherent policy towards Africa. I think it's an incoherent policy with contradictory imperatives. So I think in areas where the U.S. feels that its own national interests are at stake, and then you have to ask how it defines its national interests, then I think that they get involved. They get very involved. I think in particular, this is in two areas. This is with regards to terrorism operations, and there it's the Department of Defense. In particular, this pertains particularly to the Sahel, Sudan, the Horn of Africa in particular. And so there, U.S. Policy is very militarized. And the other dimension, I think, is the freeing up of markets, as Nisreen commented. And I think where those two overriding imperatives are not a concern, then democracy and human rights promotion do come to the fore. But I think that they're all very often overridden by these other concerns. And so it's not the overriding concern of the U.S. government, which then brings up all kinds of contradictions, where the U.S. supports dictators, authoritarian regimes across the board when it's in its interest. It supports governments that are oil producers, such as Equatorial Guinea, and looks the other way when it comes to democracy and human rights promotion. I think the other point that I would say is that we often have this perception that Africa is a country on the take, in a sense that is the recipient of all this aid, that they're the victims of starvation and conflict. And I think if you actually take an economic analysis of the country, there have been many studies that have shown the capital flight from the country. So these are illicit flows of funds, either funding sent out by domestic elites through corruption, or in many cases, multinational corporations that then extract funds from African countries and bank it abroad. And there have been many studies that shown that that capital flight is actually 10 times the amount of global aid going to Africa, or twice the amount of debt that developing countries in Africa repay every year. And so I think it's important, again, to come back to the fact that I think the biggest terrain of political struggle on the African continent is the economic terrain. And here, the African continent really has not been able to emerge from this role of extraction that it finds itself in, where it is providing these vast amounts of raw natural resources to the rest of the world's economy. And the U.S. is playing a role in facilitating this, both by hosting these companies, but also by not cracking down on a lot of these illicit flows.
Yeah, let me just jump in real quickly here. I think I would definitely reiterate what the panelists have already shared. We all know that Africa has long figured into global capitalism primarily as a site of extraction. This dynamic is continuing. Certainly, I don't suspect that we'll see some major shifts in terms of how the U.S. government approaches the African continent. That being said, there will be some changes. I do suspect, for example, that the global gag rule will be revoked under the Biden administration, and that's certainly something that we should be happy about. But fundamentally, when we talk about sort of Africa's economic position in the global economy, I don't think there's going to be much of a shift. I do want to just highlight, one thing that I think, especially in the context of the American left, is that we're not attuned sufficiently to the new actors who are continuing continuing to play a massive role, both in the economics and politics of many different African countries. Obviously, the 800-pound gorilla in the room is China. China has already become a larger trading partner with the African continent than the EU or the United States, which historically have been the dominant trading partners with African countries. There are a lot of variations in terms of how the Chinese approach their economic policies towards Africa. We see far less of an emphasis on military presence compared to, say, the West. But we should not downplay the extensive involvement of the Chinese government in the internal politics of many African countries, including Ethiopia, Sudan, and Congo, which I'm sure we can hear more about from the other panelists. And I think the last thing I would just say is that, it's not just China, right? It's not just Europe. It's not just North America. It's also countries like India. It's certainly the Gulf states, as Nisreen mentioned, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Malaysia, Turkey, Iran. So many new players are getting involved in the internal politics of African countries, primarily for economic reasons, but also for other political concerns, that we on the left really need to have an analysis that goes beyond some of the more common categories that we revert to. right? So the language of Western imperialism, while still very germane and relevant, I don't think is adequate for fully capturing the shifting position of Africa in both the global economy as well as politically. And so I think we need to really start paying more attention to how some of these new actors are impacting internal politics in many different African countries.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Zachariah, and the others and the rest of the panelists. That was great. So I'm going to shift now into questions from the audience. And in the interest of time, because we have a hard stop in about 40 minutes, I'm going to kind of fold some of these questions together. So we've had a few questions from folks who are interested in hearing more about the role of imperialism and neocolonialism on the continent today, and also efforts to address some of the legacies of colonialism, such as the partitioning and borders set up by European colonialism. And related to that, what are some challenges that may be that are happening either here or on the African continent against U.S. militarization, specifically resistance to AFRICOM, and I would add in there French militarization and so on. So imperialism, neocolonialism, and historical legacies. Anyone who'd like to jump in to start?
I guess I can just add to what I was just talking about, which is that I think that we need to develop some new frameworks for how we think about what's happening in the African context. And what I want to sort of highlight there, especially when we talk about, for example, the U.S. presence, is that even U.S. policy towards the continent is shifting. So, for example, you know, one of the questions has to do with resistance to U.S. imperialism in Africa. And I think one of the things that we have to pay attention to is that, you know, even as the U.S. government has attempted to securitize its engagement with many different African countries, its presence is actually far less obvious than it was even, say, in the 1990s and the early 2000s. Much of the U.S. footprint in Africa is clandestine. You hear these numbers of bases that exist in Africa. The vast majority are secret bases. They operate with the consent of various African political leaders, many of which for whom it is not beneficial to openly tout their ties to the U.S. government. So we don't even know really the extent of the military presence on the continent. And, you know, I think one of the things that, for example, you mentioned AFRICOM, AFRICOM isn't even based on the continent. It's actually based in Stuttgart, Germany. And that reflects kind of the shifting nature of military imperialism on the African continent today. Much more of it is happening through surveillance technologies, through drone technologies, through sites that remain largely outside from ordinary people in particular. And so it makes it much more difficult to construct a coherent resistance, because I think, by and large, it is designed to avoid kind of the obvious markers of earlier forms of colonial domination that impacted the African continent.
Yeah, if I can just jump in on that, because I totally agree with Zach. I think that we need, and this sort of chimes with what Joseph was saying, sometimes the best work a social movement can do is not actually changing the people in power, but changing the structures of power in our minds, like opening up new possibilities of cognitive liberation. And I think this pertains to what Zach was just saying in terms of we need to formulate new logics of resistance, but also new different kinds of political utopias towards which we should be heading. And so in other words, let's give an example. In the Democratic Republic of Congo is the largest producer of cobalt, which we use in batteries in the world. And it's the largest producer of copper in all of Africa. But if you look at the companies extracting that, I think eight of the top 10 companies are Chinese. The largest company doing this is Glencore, which is a Swiss company based in Switzerland, listed on the London and New York stock exchanges. And the copper is exported from the Congo largely to refineries in Malaysia, Indonesia, and China. Most of the production is happening in China. This is a globalized system. Capital is completely globalized. And so if you want to articulate, you know, resistance to this, part of that's happening in the U.S. Part of that oversight is possible in the U.S. There have been successful pressure by the Securities and Exchange Commission, by aggressive prosecutors in various courts in the United States against corruption. But in large part, it's very difficult to do that, especially because of the nature of the international financial system. And so I think that, you know, there needs to be a smart action, as there is many smart action happening from the left, with regards to changing the world, the international financial system, to get rid of a lot of the secrecy, lack of transparency, to allow for, you know, allow for Africans, Congolese, to press these issues the way that they want to press them, you know, doing things like retaining more wealth at home, preventing transfer pricing away from the Congo, creating more refinery, adding more value in country, and things like this. And so I think that there's a very sophisticated critique in terms of political economy that is emerging, that's developing. And I think that it's probably incumbent on for us on the left in the United States to try to join in with that.
Awesome. Thank you, Jason. Does anyone else want to chime in, or I can move to the next question?
I mean, I guess I can make a very brief point about this kind of, I feel like there's a dominant kind of Africa rising narrative that is emerging that too many people have bought into. It's a very sort of neoliberal narrative that pushes, you know, investment instead of development, investment instead of aid. And yet the investment dimension of it doesn't get questioned enough in terms of what does that actually look like? Does it benefit? Will it exacerbate already existing inequalities in African countries? And so as an example of that, I would say, you know, there are more and more actors that Zach mentioned that are interested in agricultural investment in Africa. And there's this kind of vision of a green revolution that is all about sort of mechanized farming and kind of importing the technology from the West to kind of spur some type of agricultural revolution. And we've seen that in Sudan with Saudi Arabia and the Emirates now owning more Sudanese land, about 5 million acres, than all of Sudan's large domestic agribusiness investors combined. And much of that land has been taken away from farmers in a country where the majority of people are still relying on agriculture to make a living. So I say this as, you know, I think we need to also critique what does investment look like? On what terms is it operating? Are we pushing a neoliberal agenda that will ultimately get us back to the point in the 80s where people were also kind of, you know, rising up against the impact of structural adjustment programs? So I think there's a little bit of a kind of repetition of that coming in, you know, through the guise of investment, right, that I think we need to be careful of. Yeah.
The one thing I would add to our conversation here is, I think in part, since we're talking about social movements, so much of what actually bears fruit at the end is predicated on very boring, mundane, organizing infrastructure. And that stuff just, it takes time. It just does. And it's boring in the sense that it's not flashy. No one, for instance, knows about, right, the organizers behind big social movements that we see. They actually put in the work that, you know, make sure that everyone is involved and so on and so forth, like the hard work. And I think in part to me is there's much progress that we do not see in terms of infrastructure construction that is not visible to us. But so in terms of going forward, what I would like to see and what I think we can do much more in terms of what Nizanin just pointed out about, you know, on the one hand, you need investment. Let's be clear about that, right? Whether you like it or not, I don't care how radical you are. I don't care how idealistic you are. If you do not have the funds in some way, shape, or form, good luck trying to realize your ideas. But that doesn't mean, however, that now you sort of close your eyes and so long as money's coming in, you just pretend like it's good. So there needs to be that critique. There needs to be that infrastructure that can actually highlight these kinds of problems that Nizanin is pointing out about land distribution and such. And I'm thinking here of a journalist, an Ethiopian journalist by the name of Zakaria Zelalem, who just published an article that he essentially exposed a company that had a bunch of fake profile pictures and managed to get a huge contract from the Ethiopian government to do oil exploration in Ogaden, in the Somali region of Ethiopia. Now, him and his skills doing some investigative journalism was able to dispel and quickly show just how shallow and how much of a dupe that whole thing was. And by the way, in that process, he also involved the current ambassador, Ethiopian ambassador to the U.S., and also exposed just how shallow the investigation was within the government. And so to me, work like that, investigative journalists like that, people who can essentially hold this investment accountable, that's the kind of infrastructure that I think is most fruitful. That's, as far as I'm concerned, that's how I see it.
Awesome. Thanks all of you so much. I have two more questions that I want to try to squeeze in. And the first one, folks have already started to address this around the question of land grabs and Jason's comments on cobalt and copper and so on. But there's been a couple of questions that have come through, both about the role of natural resources. And there's a question specifically, what would you advise African activists or movements in resistance to practically handle the foreign corporations from selling natural resources to neoliberalism? And we've touched on this a little, but if anyone would like to dig into that a little bit more.
Yeah, let me just, I work in part for New York University. New York University's budget is larger, considerably larger than the budget of the entire Democratic Republic of the Congo, right? The Democratic Republic of Congo has a population estimated of 90 million, right? The entire budget of the DRC is, roughly speaking, $5 billion, give or take. So it's nothing, right? It's nothing. And this is despite the fact that they produce enormous amounts of wealth done without creating too many jobs in the local economy, right? It's a highly mechanized kind of industry. And so it's just to emphasize the question, how important this question is. Now, there have been many experiments on the African continent of these supply chains, understand how we become accountable or complicit in these supply chains. But I think the overriding imperative is always to stand in solidarity with whoever is, you know, with the people who are most being victims of this trade on the continent. There's been, in the case of the Congo, for example, an unfortunate case where international activists impose their own understanding of the question over the needs of local communities. And so we then formulate this, for example, that ends up disempowering local communities instead of empowering those communities. And so I think we have to be very careful in the way we that are at the end of this, who are getting being abused by this.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.